Thank you. I believe the marshal is still muted.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the second argument of our April 6, 2023 panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next matter on our calendar is Brian Vitek, as trustee of Patrick Vitek versus the City of Eagan, Dakota County, and Independent School District 196. Council, just as the technology goes, I'll just mention to you, because we're having this discussion by Zoom, bear in mind we're only making an audio recording of the proceeding, so please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so the audio recording can keep track of who's attached to which argument. Also, if we have any technological issues along the way, if you have any difficulty seeing or hearing anyone, somehow bring it to our attention. We'll pause the proceedings and try to get the technology sorted out. So as I understand it, counsel, you are dividing your time. Counsel, for in total for the appellant side, will have 15 minutes with an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal, and the respondent will have a total of 15 minutes. As I understand it, each of the three appellants in this case, the county, the city, and the school district, are dividing 5 minutes for each of you in your argument in chief. And then, as I understand, you're parsing out the rebuttal. 1 minute to, I think, the county of Dakota, right? And 2 minutes to each of the others, the city. I don't know how someone drew the short straw there and got only 1 minute. And we'll see what you can. I've never seen a 1 minute argument. We'll see what you can do with that. Council for appellant, we know the order that you're going in. My understanding is the Dakota County first, and then the City of Eagan, and then the school district. Is that the order of the arguments today? All right. Council, for the county, whenever you are ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. William Topka, T-O-P-K-A, appearing on behalf of Dakota County. May it please the court, the county's appeal today is about whether or not Dakota County's decisions not to implement a speed limit in a school zone warrants the imposition of official immunity. As the court's already recognized, my time here today is extremely limited, and so I'm going to focus on what I believe to be the meat of the issue, and that's official immunity and whether the county's decisions were discretionary. And so just as a quick primer, official immunity applies to protect an official's decision. It essentially applies so that there's no second guessing of that official, and so that his future decisions won't be chilled. In this particular case for the county, that official is the county's transportation engineer, Mark Krebsbach. And he decided no less than three times not to implement a speed limit in the disputed Diffley school zone, 2016, 2018, and 2019. In 2016 and 2018, he reached the decision for basically the same reasons. He reasoned that there was no evidence demonstrating a need to implement a speed limit in that particular school zone. He cited low pedestrian counts and a lack of accidents involving pedestrians.
And you'd agree, Mr. Topka, that his analysis didn't involve weighing of policy considerations, cost of having a reduced speed limit or anything like that?
Not in that particular decision, Your Honor. No, that did not. This is just as it applies to official immunity, and these are professional judgments that he's making. So no, that did not involve weighing policy decisions. He was also concerned that reducing the speed limit might cause a safety issue that didn't already exist. He explained to the constituents that he was concerned that without a physical barrier requiring people to slow down in the school zone, that traffic would be snarled and that potentially would be a danger to pedestrians. These decisions, Your Honors, were discretionary. They used Mr. Krebsbach's professional judgment. He used his professional judgment by having to analyze the design of the roadway. He used his professional judgment by analyzing whether that particular design would encourage or discourage drivers to slow down without physical impediments. He used his professional judgment to analyze the danger in connection with some drivers driving slower than other drivers and the risk that would pose to the pedestrians. And then what he ultimately did is he took all those, the analysis that he did, he applied it to the known quantitative risk of the lack of pedestrian counts and the lack of pedestrian accidents in the area and came up with his decision. It was all the result of his professional judgment, Your Honors. And in 2019, he reached the same conclusion, albeit for a different reason. In 2019, he was again posed with the issue of implementing a speed limit in the school zone. And he again denied that decision, but this time around denied it because he felt that he needed assistance from county partners, specifically the school district. And he did not believe
that strikes me, Mr. Topka, as calling for a different decision-making set. Than maybe the professional judgment you've argued that he exercised the prior occasions by reviewing safety data and using his experience and experience across the country. Why should we accord to him for the 2019 decision official immunity?
Well, because it again involved his professional judgment. And let me explain why. So The guide sets out the process for implementing a speed limit in a school zone, and it talks about the things that needed to be done. He needed to review that particular guidance that the state puts out, and he needed to apply his experience, real world experience. How does this work in the real world? Who do I need at the table to discuss the implementation of this? Who needs to be part of that discussion? And that was where his professional judgment came in, his real world experience in implementing this. But I also think it's important to note that whether he was right or wrong and whether he needed the school district's involvement is completely irrelevant. Even if he didn't, he decided that he did, and he made that decision based upon his professional judgment. And Your Honors, I'm running out of time, so I would just ask that the court reversed the lower court and find that the county is entitled to common law official immunity. Thank you.
Thank you. You will have a moment of rebuttal. Next up, I believe, is City of Eagan Council. You can correct me if I'm wrong, if you're going in a different order.
That is correct. Pierre Renier on behalf of the City of Eagan. And I will be discussing with you the issues of duty, no duty owed by the city to the plaintiff in this particular matter for several reasons. But there's no material facts that are in dispute that would prevent this court from reversing the lower court on the question of summary judgment as to the City of Eagan. This accident happened on a county road, not on a city street. There was no city street involved whatsoever. It was, and the issue is raised is the question of speed limit. The plaintiff's expert, the only thing he raises is a question that perhaps if the speed were 30 miles an hour instead of 45, the accident may not have happened. There's no other grounds for his claim. So it's a speed case. And the speed limit is set up by statute. And who does it? The underlying speed limit of 45 miles an hour is set by the state of Minnesota. They're not a defendant here. They set that. The city had no involvement in that. And the school zone speed limit issue is one that's decided by the local authority that has jurisdiction over a particular road, in this case, the county.
If this the city did receive complaints about the pedestrian complaints, correct?
That is correct.
And the district court, as I understand it, took the view that the city's inaction was active in a way that creates misfeasance instead of nonfeasance. Can you address, if I correctly summarized what the district court, how the district court reasoned, and if so, what's wrong with that reasoning, if anything?
because the leading cases that deal with this question of third-person liability, Doe versus Brandon and the DeMogler case, if I pronounce it correctly, there the court said specifically, having actual knowledge of a dangerous condition and choosing to do nothing is nonfeasance, not misfeasance, because the misfeasance has to be active misconduct by the entity and doing nothing. And that's exactly what the plaintiffs are claiming in this case, is that the city did nothing. They had the complaints and they didn't do anything to do it. What they did do was they referred the people to the county and said, you go to the county because we have no control over a school zone speed limit. And that is the state highway commissioner's office sent an email out saying sole responsibility for putting in that was the county.
I understand the district court took those referrals as a type of action as opposed to inaction, constituting a form of misfeasance.
Right. And that's contrary to the Supreme Court decisions dealing with this issue, saying that non-action is misfeasance.
But the position of the district court was that by actually making the referrals, there was action.
They were making a decision to send them to the proper party. That wasn't active misconduct. And that's what the court has interpreted the misfeasance, not the, the misfeasance has to be active misconduct by the entity. And referring somebody to the proper authority as established by state law certainly isn't misconduct. And that's the basis of our also claiming official immunity, is that's a judgment that they made in interpreting the statute. The other grounds that we have is that Johnson versus Thief River Falls case that made it clear where the court said, this is a 1969 decision, the municipality is liable for negligence in the maintenance repair of its own highway street sidewalks if such highway street or sidewalk is under the municipality's control. And in the absence of an express agreement to maintain the road, the city would not have any liability in this case. And then the third grounds for, and the plaintiffs never addressed those cases. There's a Supreme Court case after Johnson in 1986 reaffirming that decision and two unpublished cases. Neither the district court or the plaintiffs, either on this appeal or at the district court level, even addressed those. So I see my time is up, so.
Thank you, Mr. Rainier. You will have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the school district.
May it please the court and counsel, Mark Hodkinson on behalf of Independent School District 196. As a matter of law, the district court erred in finding that a duty existed as to the school district and that it was not entitled to immunity. The district court failed to identify any specific disputed facts that are material to these legal questions. Judge Ross, you're asking about the third party, the own conduct exception to the third party rule in terms of the duty issue. I think plaintiff's argument is going further. It is circular. It would say that anytime you don't do anything or make the decision not to do anything, you are being actively, it's active misconduct. And that would swallow, I'm not being articulate enough, that concept would swallow that rule. There would never be any thing such as nonfeasance if that was true. In this case, there's just no evidence that the school district was involved or even alleged to have been actively malfeasance or active misconduct.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Hodkinson, going a different direction. Why doesn't the school district's policies designed to protect students who have to cross minor arterial roads, why doesn't that constitute assumption of a duty that the school might not otherwise have had?
I think that, well, because, I mean, it, Well, but that's, if that was true, Your Honor, that would be true of any schools, any street anywhere near a school. And clearly a school district has no, can't be said to have a duty to have, get every student from every student's home, have a, somehow a duty to make sure they get to school safely.
I thought it only dealt with minor arterial roads, which by some definition were more major roads like this county road here.
You think that the policy that you're referring to, or the state guide, or whatever the authority is that you're referring to, Your Honor, has suggestions? It was still left. It's a discretionary decision to the school board as to whether to declare that road hazardous. And then it was further a discretionary decision to decide to further with the balancing resources and cost and student safety to set up the free busing for the students in this area. Can I just jump real quick to the duty issue? Because I urge the court, because the amicus brief details this extensively. Neither the district court or the plaintiff can cite any authority recognizing a negligence duty owed by a school district to students not in the school district's custody, not on school property, or not participating in school supervised or sponsored activities or events. So the law has never imposed such a duty. It would create such an infinite exposure and liability to every district in Minnesota, and for impose duties on districts far beyond anything that is in their control. To find such a duty for this error correcting court would to create such a gigantic change in Minnesota law that it would just it would be all encompassing. Can I just jump real quick to the immunity issue again? I don't think that the district court identified any specific evidence to point to why the district was not entitled to statutory discretionary immunity. It even found in its order and memorandum on page 3 that the district did make these discretionary decisions and that the statute 123B.88 says that those decisions about student transportation are in the sole discretion of the school district. Unless the court has any more questions, I'll reserve a minute or two for rebuttal, please.
You do have a minute of reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Actually, 2 minutes that you've reserved, and we'll allocate that to you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Will Flegel, and I represent the Vitek family respondents in this matter. Because there are genuine issues of material fact on the predicates to the claimed immunities, and because the facts show that appellants voluntarily assumed a duty they may not otherwise have had and then negligently performed it, the trial court was correct to deny their motion for summary judgment and should be affirmed. Unless the court has a different preference, I think I'm just going to follow the order of my colleagues. But I'm happy to address any issue that's at the top of your mind instead.
I'm struggling with what material facts are in dispute at this point.
With respect to each of the issues, Your Honor, as to the duty issue, maybe I'll address that first. Pointed out the five predicate facts. I can go through each of them. The first was a discussion between Commissioner Atkins and County Engineer Kresbach on December the 14th, 2017, that the county was working closely with the Independent School District on the project. That's at Atkins deposition, pages 179 through 83 and Exhibit 57. Secondly, there were discussions between Commissioner Atkins and the city engineer, Mr. Gortner, on November 15th, 2018. That's Atkins deposition, page 57 through 64. There's also Egan's document 1692 on that. Third, written authorization to execute the joint powers agreement between the city and the county on November the 6th, 2018, to provide, quote, a safe and efficient transportation system on Diffley Road at the Braddock intersection, close quote. That's Atkins' deposition, pages 50 through 53.
Just to be clear on that point, the tragic collision in this case did not occur at that intersection, correct?
It's one block over.
Right, but not at the intersection that was subject to the agreement that you're talking about.
But the undertaking, Your Honor, would have embraced the location where the incident occurred, because the speed limit would not just be for half of a block.
Can I take you to a question specific to the district court's analysis?
Yes, please.
I haven't been able to understand this. How is the city's referral to the county misfeasance? Doesn't the alleged misfeasance have to be somehow a cause and effect to the plaintiff's injuries to constitute actionable conduct so that you can create some duty when a third party's actions are the direct cause?
That would be a logical inference you could draw, that there should at least be some causal connection between the active wrongdoing and the ultimate disposition. This is a rare case where we had actually 10 members of the public saying, will someone have to die before this change is...
No, I understand there's some horrible circumstances leading up to it and some foreseeable issues. My question is, how is the city's referral to the county, how is that misfeasance?
And that was my point, Your Honor. I'm not trying to play on sympathy here. The fact that it became foreseeable that an incident of this type would occur in light of the complaints of members. So anything that distracts, delays, defers the incorporation of a reduced speed zone is in fact a cause in fact.
But how is it misfeasance? I still don't understand that. How?
Yes.
Help me over that logical jump.
Yes. And I think you put your finger on the key here. The district court used the phrase something like active inaction or something like that, which I think gets us into some troubling territory. We, at page 35 and footnote 45 of our brief, we listed a number of examples of misfeasance. And it does.
Just so I'm clear, and sorry for interrupting, I'm trying to take this one piece at a time because there's so many elements to your argument and the district court's reasoning. I gather you're not defending the district court's logical position or the logic position taken by the district court that inaction can become action by nature of the inaction being active. You're not defending that logic.
The shortest answer I can give you is yes, I'm not. Trying to follow the iteration there. I think for purposes of simplicity, Your Honor, you can use the difference between a negligent act and a negligent omission. And I would indicate to you that however heinous an inaction is, it does not become an action. But the reason that the trial court was correct here in holding that there was active wrongful conduct by these distracting referrals, it's not my job, it's somebody else's job, quit bothering me, go here, is that delay process ultimately results in the death of Patrick. Because had they done what they promised to do in establishing this policy, to do a reduction of speed within the school zone, the incident would have been avoided. So the wrongful active conduct is the misleading that occurred. That's our characterization. I do want to draw—
And you're saying the misleading was referring the city, which doesn't have any control over the speed limit, referring complainants to the governmental entity that does have control. That's what you're saying was the misfeasance.
I've got a slight permutation of that. saying, I don't have anything to do with that, go check with one of these other two guys, is a misrepresentation of fact when you're engaged in a tripartite effort to reduce the speed in a school zone.
How is that a misrepresentation when you are stating the fact that you have no control? I mean, isn't it undisputed that this was a county road?
This was a county road, but the city has responsibility.
For the county road, the county has responsibility, correct?
No, Your Honor, not within the city, it doesn't.
What are you basing that argument on?
Minnesota Statute 160.02, subdivision, I think it's subdivision 18, where a county state aid highway runs through a city, the city council is the responsible entity under 162.02, as it must approve the plan for the construction and maintenance under 162.02, subdivision 8. It's not, as my colleague represented, that they have no voice in this at all, because it's a
this case. But Mr. Flegel, this case doesn't involve construction or maintenance issues. It has to do with speed. And I don't see the city or the school district, for that matter, having any ability to make decisions and about the speed in this school zone. Why am I wrong about that?
Okay, then I've done a poor job of acquainting you with the facts, because the three entities all had to work cooperatively. If I can circle back, please, to Judge Ross's question first, Judge Bjorkman. Judge Ross, one of the curious things is that if the fact issue were resolved in favor of the school's position in favor of the county's position, that they asked the school district and the school district refused to provide them with a necessary traffic plan, that would be active wrongful conduct. That fact issue needs to be resolved, which takes me to Judge Bjorkman on the role here. Each of them, and in our brief, I thought I had spelled out the unique role that each of them played. The school has to provide a plan. The county has to undertake a study in addition to the work of the state. And the city has to also participate in that under 162.02. All three are required. And I believe that Mr. Topka indicated that in his defense, it was not us alone. All three are required. So that's the fact issue on why there's both a voluntary undertaking and why this implicates does not implicate official act immunity.
But one of the issues here is, in addition to the issue that Judge Ross raised in terms of misdemeanors, which seems to be missing here, is the issue of control. And it appears that the Independent School District 196, neither the school district nor the city have control over that. I mean, you're citing two statutes that refer to construction or maintenance, but we're talking about making a change to it, and that's a very different and distinct issue. And the case, I mean, how do you address cases such as, you know, Vote v. Johnson, where they talk about how a district had no liability for a child hit by a car when his school bus approached, which it seems to be even more egregious in a way and closer, more closely tied to the school. And the Supreme Court there held that the child did not come within the scope of the driver's duty to care for or protect the child. Here, the school had a program for busing, but this child that sadly died was riding his bike to school. He wasn't even taking part in the school busing program to alleviate this issue. So how do you establish control given our precedent?
You raised three points in your question, Judge Reyes, so let me respond to each of the three, if I may, please. The first circles back to a question that Judge Bjorkman asked me and that I failed adequately to address, and that's how maintenance is implicated here. the placing of a speed sign is part of the maintenance of the roadway. Secondly, on the Johnson case, that is a factually distinguishable pattern from us because of this important reason. That defendant acted alone. Here we have the involvement of all three entities. Lastly, on your busing question, the busing policy also applied to walkers and to bikers. Specifically, the North Elementary plan, Yes, it was in the Dayon, D-A-Y-O-N deposition at pages 18 through 19, they undertook responsibility to try to ensure that all children were safe, whether they were walking or biking to or from the facility. That's at pages 18 through 19 of Dan's testimony. So you, I don't think it'd be fair to distinguish that plan as a busing only plan that does not apply to Patrick. It applied to him according to the school's representative.
Mr. Flegel, going back to duty and as applied to the school district, the district court seemed to reason this way, that the district's choosing not to prepare a school route plan likely goes beyond passive nonfeasance.
And, may I interrupt you?
Yes.
May I interrupt you just there, Your Honor? That's the point I was making to you earlier, where if the fact issue about what the school chose to do is resolved a certain way, that would be active misconduct by refusing, by withholding a plan. It's not, I didn't develop one. It's not inaction. It's, I've got one, but I'm not giving it to you. Okay. But that's only one of the potential factual bases on which you could find.
How is not providing a completed plan action?
How is hiding a document in action? You're hiding it. It's not, I can't find it, or it's refusing to provide it, sir.
How is refusing to undertake action an action?
I think I addressed that earlier, that if it's purely inaction, an omission to act, that is not constitute active conduct. But here the trial court found fact issues. Because of the existence of fact issues on all these predicates, this should be resolved by a jury. The Court of Appeals should not engage in fact finding here.
Well, isn't the district court prohibited from fact finding as well? Isn't it just you seem to indicate that the district court found facts, but isn't the district court just limited to determine whether there are facts in that material dispute? It seems like the district court went a step too far here.
Judge Ross, I'm the only one to go over time here.
Take a moment to answer that question.
All right. The issue, can I ask you to please give me that again briefly, Judge Reyes? I'm sorry.
Sure. Now I'll try to do my best. Isn't the issue that the district court, in order to...
I think I've got it. It's the role of the district court, and you're correct. There is a unique role that the trial court does play with regard to determining the existence of predicates for immunity. This loops actually back into the jurisdictional issue that we had raised, because in the presence of a finding by the trial judge, there are fact issues. A fact finder's role becomes essential, and we would say that should be the outcome here. Thank you for allowing me to respond, Judge Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Flegel. Now we'll turn to the serial rebuttal opportunities, and I believe the county... Well, I'll let you choose who goes first. You know what the time restrictions are.
Your Honor, I'll go first. William Topka, TOPKA for the county. We actually have no rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right, well, thank you. So that leaves 5 minutes between the city and the school district. So we'll just adjust your time to 2.5 minutes each, since you agreed to equal time, unless you've chosen a different approach.
That's fine with me.
All right, you may proceed.
Thank you, Pierre Rainier, rebuttal. There was a question asked about the court, the district court getting this concept of active inaction. That statement of active inaction was first argued, not by the district court, but by the plaintiff. In the plaintiff's brief to the district court, they raised this comment that that was active inaction. And what they listed as active inaction was the city did not take any action. The city actively told Egan residents to talk to the county, yet they did nothing on its own. These are quotes right from their brief to the district court. And they said this constitutes active inaction. And we asked, well, where is the court cases that support that concept? And there weren't any. That it was just a new standard to come out. We submit that isn't there. The other thing is that what the plaintiff is asking this court to do is to rewrite the state statutes regulating the duties and authority assigned to each of the government entities that operate roadways throughout the state. They're asking the court to give to the cities the authority to operate and control county roads by setting the speed limits on a county road, and they can't do that. They don't have authority. The sole responsibility for that, and the county accepts that as a sole responsibility. The county engineer and the county traffic engineer both testify the city has no authority or no responsibility with regard to setting a school zone speed limit. That was actively accepted by the county. So there is no action. The other part that was not addressed was the Craycraft case and the public duty doctrine. And that definitely applies in this situation to the position of the city. And what the district court there found that Craycraft didn't apply because the Craycraft court said a governmental entity that owns and operates the road cannot claim defense under the public duty doctrine. Well, that's true. We accept that, but we don't own and operate. In fact, the district court specifically found that the county owned and operated the county road. So Craycraft definitely applies. So
thank you, Mr. Rainier.
Doctrines would apply. I'm past my time. I apologize.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for your argument. Counsel for the school district.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mark Hodkinson for ISD 196. I have two things. One is I urge the court to follow its precedent and the precedent of the Supreme Court in the Platon versus Gaines case, where the poor student decided not to get on the bus at school and walk and decided to walk home and was struck and killed by a car. The court in both this court and the Supreme Court found that the district had no duty and was also entitled to immunity. The other thing I would like just to point out is that it seems to me that the both the district court and the plaintiff's positions are illogically inconsistent. As to duty, the plaintiff claims that somehow that this issue we've gone through about the failure to act was active misconduct. So that, again, they're saying, well, you didn't do anything. And yet, as to all the immunity arguments, they claim we did nothing and did not make, did not make discretionary decisions, which is contrary, again, to the evidence that the district court found that the school district had made decisions to try to mitigate the dangers of this dangerous road being near its school and providing busing when it had no legal responsibility to do so. Thank you very much. I have nothing further unless the court has a question for me.
It does not appear as if any of the panel members have any additional questions, so thank you. And thank you to all counsel for your very thorough briefing in this matter and for your oral arguments, and including thank you for the inclusion of the amicus brief of Minnesota School Boards Association. The matter is very well briefed, very thoroughly briefed, very well argued by all of you. Your client should all be very happy with the representation they've received in this matter. Of course, we appreciate that there's serious, tragic circumstances that led to this case, but we will issue our opinion on the issues of law without regard to the, to those emotional concerns, but we are mindful of them, and we're as sad as I'm sure all of the council are about the circumstances of the case. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. So thank you all, and have a good afternoon.